My name is Gerry McNally, as Sirius explained. I am the current president of the Confederation of European Probation. And I think one of the things I wanted to take an opportunity, particularly this morning, to do was to explain, because not everybody understands what probation is. It's always interesting when I have groups that I ask people, what do they think probation is? We get a variety of explanations and answers. So that sometimes it's more important just to kind of get a common understanding of what probation actually means. And to do that, because probation is all across Europe, in fact it's all across the world in various different jurisdictions, but it's about trying to have a common understanding of it. So I've just taken this from the Council of Europe probation rules, so therefore it's more of an independent, direct and very simple explanation. So probation itself, probation relates to the implementation of community sanctions, and I think the word community is very important in this. And community sanctions and measure defined and imposed by law. So there has to be a legal basis for probation in the first place. It includes a range of activities and interventions, which include supervision, guidance and assistance, aimed at social inclusion of an offender, as well as contributing to social, to community safety. So effectively, you're looking at, it's we're not police, we're not prisons, we're not anything. We're looking very much at a constructive engagement with people about changing behaviour, about supervision, guidance and assistance. When I was training as a probation officer, we used the mantra from what is still the law in Ireland, the 1907 Probation of Offenders Act, that the job of a probation officer was to assist, advise and befriend. So therefore it's much more about public engagement, personal engagement and working directly with people. And community sanctions, because I think, again, to understand what community sanctions are, it's about maintaining offenders in the community. And but it involves some restrictions on their liberty through the imposition of conditions or obligations. So again, it's about the engagement and retention in the community as far as practical and possible. And it designates any sanction imposed by judicial or administrative authority. And I think you're looking at it's an alternative as well to custody, and it's outside the prison, or imprisonment outside the prison establishment. So again, you're talking about sanctions managed and based in the community. And I think that's a distinction that's often quite confused at times as to where it actually fits. But also I think it's important to understand it in terms of the jigsaw. Because if you look around the room, and if you look around all of the meetings around radicalisation, criminal justice systems, there's a range of experts, there's a range of knowledge coming from courts, the judiciary, lawyers, human rights, defence, police, detection, imprisonment and retention and control, and then there's probation. So it's about having that network. It's a continuum of agencies and cooperation that's very important to get together. So that's what probation in broad terms is. What I want to explain then is what's the Confederation of European Probation, because I think it's important to understand that not every country is the same, and even no matter how close we get and how similar we get, we've got different traditions and different ways of working, but it's important to understand what's the core principles that bring us together within probation to understand each other. So in 1981, the Confederation of European Probation was established, and the idea is to create a network of probation agencies and probation bodies in all the countries and jurisdictions across Europe. The classic thing is we need to be talking to each other, and probation began to do that in the early 1980s. And I think that's one of the strengths that we now identify as important, that it's about cross-jurisdiction communication. It's about information sharing and knowledge. The objectives of the CEP are to unite probation organisations across Europe. Now, unite does not mean make them the same. It's about bringing them together in the same room and exchanging and cooperating. And I think that's one of the big things that I was just mentioning. To professionalise, it's about bringing standards up to the best possible quality and assurance across Europe. So it's about supporting and professionalising and making things better. And again, it's about raising the profile of probation in Europe, because sometimes people don't remember. Everybody thinks of prison. It's very easy to visualize what a prison is, but it's not as easy to visualize or understand what a probation or a community sanction is. So that's part of our communications agenda, is to help people understand what things like that are. And I think if you want to think it in terms of numbers, if you take it that for every one person in prison, in any one jurisdiction or in any one area across Europe, there are probably, depending on the jurisdiction, between 3 and 4 other people already on supervision in the community. Now, more is not necessarily better, but I think it gives you an idea of proportionality, that as far as possible we should be minimising the use of custody and maximising the use of community-based sanctions for the best results. And I always like to use this map just to remind people what Europe means. The outer circle is the Council of Europe, which is 47 members, and that's a very large Europe, which goes right across to from Eastern Europe, but also coming back right across, all across Western Europe. Within that, you've got a free trade area, you've got the European Union and the European zone, and you've got the Schengen area. So there's a myriad of different standards and different ways of working right across Europe. And I think it's important to understand the sheer size of Europe, but also the complexity of Europe. But it's a good opportunity to work together. It's more of an illustration rather than anything more than like that, and I always like it as a picture. The Confederation of European Probation has 60 member organisations across Europe, but also we've now extended to work with universities because we've now begun to see the importance of quality assurance, research and knowledge development. And I think that's the kind of thing that we've got to develop, because nothing stands still. And I think criminal justice traditionally has had a habit of staying still, and I think it's important that criminal justice agencies, including probation agencies, have to be agile, have to be alert, have to be aware of new developments. And I think that's part of what I'm going to be talking about. But particularly, we've got a very large resource, and I'll give you the email address or the URL address later on. But we've got a large network, and we would encourage people to join in, both in the Twitter accounts, the LinkedIn accounts, to actually share and contribute to that bedrock of information, because it's about developing knowledge and about exchanging knowledge and exchanging expertise. We're also part of other groups, and particularly in relation to radicalisation. I just mentioned the RAN network because Meryl is coming after me and she is representing the RAN network, so I'm not going to talk in any great detail about it. But we're involved with it, and we would see probation as having an important role in that. So at the very bottom, you'll see there, for example, we held a joint expert group within probation and the RAN network in Dublin last year. And I think it's important because that comes back to the key message about cooperation and coordination across agencies. Because not just in criminal justice, but in most professions and most areas of work, there's the silo mentality. We all tend to work separately and independently of each other. And the importance of coordination and cooperation can sometimes be missed. So it's that joined up part that we think is very important that the RAN contributes to. But again, we will look at it. The other strong authority that probation organisations see a role in is with the Council of Europe, which is already bringing together a lot of key resources and which are important in actually getting the idea of what we're doing and how we're doing it. So I just draw your attention to some of the key messages that are coming out from, for example, the Council of Europe handbook on practical ways about addressing. They're not exclusively targeted, for example, at probation or at prisons, but they cross over. And again, I think Meryl will cover this much more detail following this. Because I think some of the key messages is, for example, that there's not one single identity and there's no one single description. And there's a whole range of resources, assessment, screening. There's challenges in how do you identify, how do you motivate, and how do you invest in new programs and the role of staff. So you can see that's a kind of a common theme, and I think I'm going to be coming back in a few moments to what specifically that relates to probation, or that role. But I'm just showing you how the same ideas come across in different areas. Again, the Council of Europe has produced guidelines on how to do things. But again, I think these are the key messages that I think from the point of view of probation organisations, we need to be more alert about. But also we need all our partners in criminal justice to be aware that probation is there and it's an option. Particularly if you look at the role of custody as a last resort. If custody is the last resort, then you need to be aware of the community-based resources, and we need to be working with them and using them most efficiently. We need to be aware of extremism in the community, because it's not just in prisons. And there's a temptation at times that we become preoccupied with radicalization in prisons, radicalization or extremism emerging in prisons. Yes, it's there. Yes, it's a problem. But, and I would ask the question because I don't know the answer for it, it's coming a lot from the communities. So we need to work out how can we engage better in the communities? Can we use community organisations, and can we use the probation organisations with their local knowledge and their engagement in the community to address those things? We also need to understand culture and religion and those kind of things, which are again not just confined. It's that this is about the broad spread and about understanding how people work. And the key one that comes up all the time is the question of interagency cooperation and information. Interagency cooperation, everybody is for it, but how do we do it? Everybody is in favour of interagency cooperation, but I'm not quite sure that if you don't understand your partner organisations, how you cooperate then becomes the difficulty, or the depth to which you cooperate, or how you develop engagement. So it's about, we need to have much more mutual understanding of how it does. But these are things that are already highlighted. And one I'll come back to is disengagement or de-radicalisation. Because sometimes what your objectives are can sometimes make it very difficult to actually achieve them. But these are just referring to some of the highlights that are out there. In probation practice, this is particularly what I want to talk about this morning, is what are the challenges for probation organisations in the community? And I think the headline one was, not all jurisdictions have the same experience or sense of risk with radicalisation. For example, with Islamic terrorism, it's very obvious that probation services, like in Belgium, where people who were on probation have been involved, in the Netherlands, in France, and in Spain have a very real and immediate experience of radicalisation among people on supervision in the community. But if you take other jurisdictions, and I can put my hands up here in this situation, in Ireland, it's not something that is it's on the probation register, because we don't have any radicals on supervision. We don't have very many radicals that we know of, at least that the police are telling us about, in the jurisdiction. And so it becomes a different priority. But for us, radicalisation means something slightly different. We're talking about political terrorism in that situation. And for example, Northern Ireland, and I see Tim at the back there, has enormous experience in working with political extremism and about different methodologies in working with that. So I think we have to become aware that radicalisation and extremism is not just the current problem, or the immediate one, or the one that's in the newspapers. If you go to Eastern Europe, you've got far-right extremism, which is quite dangerous and threatening. You've got hate crime extremism in a lot of jurisdictions, and it's very alive and real on probation supervision. So it's about understanding the different forms that radicalisation takes place. It's not just Islamic terrorism, because that's what's in the news today. We've had 100 years of IRA and extremism in Ireland of a different form. The Germany has had Baader-Meinhof, the Red Brigades. We can go through the whole history of every country that's had its own version of extremism. So it's not somebody else's problem. It's a common problem that reappears in different forms, in different jurisdictions, at different times. So the challenge is to understand that and to make our own members. So for example, a challenge for the CEP is to help our own members to understand what radicalisation could mean in their jurisdiction, and to help them to network and exchange and work with their colleagues not just in their country, but across the jurisdictions, to learn the best possible ways of doing things. The biggest thing, I think we all have done it, particularly anybody who's been working for a long time in criminal justice, you see the same things coming around again. We try something, it doesn't work, and then 20 years later, we try it again, and it still doesn't work. One of the most important things we need to do is to learn from history and from practice, and to keep that knowledge alive and keep developing and examining things. One of the big things that people, and I know Meryl again will talk about this, is about assessment and interventions. And there's lots of expectations that if we use the risk assessment instrument, it will give us a result. It will tell us, is this person dangerous or is this person not? And I think we can be sometimes put in great danger by our own expectations. You can put too much faith in instruments, because they're based on knowledge as it is at a particular time. Probation organisations have been using risk assessment instruments for general offending, for sex offending, for domestic violence, for whole ranges of effect. And one of the things that everybody has learned is they're not perfect. They talk and they give you results primarily about general populations based on knowledge that we've had and trends that we've learned over years. But to give you an estimate, it's not a reliable label and it doesn't always work. So we can sometimes become prisoners of our own kind of tools or instruments. And I think that's where we've got to remember there has to be a degree of professional judgment and discretion always used in how we use these. The same applies to interventions. Sometimes we get a program, or somebody develops a program, and it's a very good program with a particular population at a particular time in a particular location, but does it transfer? Can it be moved and can it be repeated? And I think, this is one of the things in probation that we have to be very conscious of, is just because it works, or it seemed to work today, does it work tomorrow? And the biggest challenge in interventions is, if it seems to work today, what's the results in 5 years' time? And if in 5 years' time it's not working, you've been going down a cul-de-sac for a very long time. So sometimes we become prisoners of our programs, or prisoners of our particular approaches. We've got to be thinking, and we've got to be agile and changing and evaluating what we're doing all the time. So sometimes, again, it's about expectations. We have to be cautious about the amount of expectations we can put on any individual programs. I'm giving you a more cautionary tale, because I think in probation practice, what we deal with is complexity. We deal with people, and people are not simple. People are complicated, and how they change is even more complicated, and often is unpredictable. But it's a challenge. Across jurisdictions in Europe, there's a different experience and knowledge of terrorism and violent extremism. Some organisations and probation simply don't see it as appropriate to be involved with them. And I think that's one of the areas that we have to look at, that if we're working on sanctions in the community, we've got to take everybody on. And we've got to learn how to work with everyone. But you do that not as a solo runner, but as part of a team, and a criminal justice team. So a lot of what I talk about is probation is part of the criminal justice team. It brings a particular perspective which is valuable and important. It isn't as loud and it doesn't beat a big drum, but I think it should be listened to. And then the other big thing is local priorities. And the local priorities, if you think that there are three, and some jurisdictions have a dozen, two dozen people on probation who are at risk of radicalisation, what proportion of your resources can you put into those 12 people if you've got 10,000 other people on supervision? And how do you balance resource allocation and investment? Because I think this is one of the challenges of things. In probation, a lot of work is done on that resources follow risk. So obviously you put more of your investment, more of your skill, more of your best staff, more of your profession into the highest risk people, the most threatening and dangerous people, which brings you back to the question of assessment. Because are you assessing them, and does the assessment work? Is it identifying the right people? Because you could well be putting a lot of resources into particular people at supervision, but maybe it's the wrong people. And that's the part that we need to know. And it's also part where you need multi-agency working, because you need to be talking to the police, you need to be talking to the prison, and you need to be exchanging data. And that becomes a question that I'll definitely be coming back on. How do you exchange data? And how do we exchange data? Because while we have great headline trust between the organisations, when you get down to actually exchanging information, it becomes quite a challenge. The notion of consent is also an issue. In community sanctions, in almost all instances, are done with the consent of the individual. The conditions are imposed with the consent of the individual, because that's seen as an alternative to custody, and therefore the person, you need the person's engagement. And generally, if you want to work with people to change the behaviour, to address the behaviour, you need a degree of engagement and cooperation. And I think one of the things that perhaps I've, again going back to experience, I've been working with low risk, middle risk, high risk offenders for 40 years, and one of the things I learned very quickly, well, not very quickly all the time, that if somebody is not willing, somebody is not engaging, you're not going to force them to engage. Because I think that's where, if you've got to think of more subtle, more sophisticated ways of engaging people, and it's also a way of identifying risk, that if people don't engage, you can't force people to engage. You can force them to attend, you can force them to sit in a room, but you can't enforce what they actually believe and what they think. I think that's about the limitations of interventions as well. And again, I've mentioned already the capacity of proportionality and resource. These are challenges that work in the community, and they're challenges for probation organisations across Europe. The positive things are that probation in general, across all of Europe, probation is professional, skilled and experienced people. The vast majority of probation officers across Europe are either graduates in psychology, social work, social pedagogues and law, and criminal justice, criminology of various sort. They generally have at least a basic degree, or in most cases they have master's degrees. There's in-career development constantly going on with probation organisations. So there's a development, because you need, the example I always use, because I can talk about myself, if I was doing now what I did in 1978 when I joined the probation service first, I think that would be a bit old-fashioned and remiss, because things have changed dramatically. Knowledge has changed, knowledge continues to change, and you've got to constantly be upskilling and up-developing. But probation organisations are generally well-versed in that, because that's what they do. So there is a lot of things. So there is potential there to use probation more, because you've got a very strong resources. And again, there's an awareness of the, hopefully, of the different kinds of it. It's about us helping those probation organisations to become aware of them. But the experiences, different countries have different ways, and this is why sharing becomes important. And again, I look at him, it's important that you get the experience of Northern Ireland to be shared across other jurisdictions, but the experience of Germany and Poland and the Czech Republic in dealing with the various extremist organisations, because people learn how to cope with these things, and they learn, and it's important that they share that knowledge. But I think most importantly of all, and I think that's perhaps it's what's one of the unique selling points of probation, is that probation works with, it focuses on people, behaviour, relationships and personal and community engagement. A good probation officer, I would suggest, is out there in the community, knows what's happening in the community, engages with the networks in the community, and is aware of what's happening in their community. Because that's part of what we do, and how, that's the skill and the knowledge base that we have. But also, we're aware of complexity. Because we've been supervising high-risk offenders, complex offenders, for many, many years of different kinds. There's a lot of transferable skills and knowledge in working with both risk assessment, in program development, evaluation and risk management, because that's what probation officers have been doing for at least 100 years in most jurisdictions. But it's about that, how do you make that work as part of the criminal justice team? And I think that's where the part about bringing it in. And I keep coming back to multi-agency and multidisciplinary working. Multi-agency, I think all criminal justice agents will say they want to work and cooperate with each other. But, and there's always a but, it's about the level of knowledge, the level of trust, and the level of engagement, and the sharing of data. And I think everybody will be able to tell you the story where I would have done something if I had known. But you're not going to know because so-and-so isn't going to tell you. Because knowledge is power, and then there's a whole other argument that can go along about that. And criminal justice agencies are as bad as everybody else in falling into that mistake. And I think one of the things I would say to you today is that I would make a plea that we get better at sharing what we know with each other. And I think we all agree with it in theory, but we're not great at it in practice. And then we come down to multidisciplinary working. So you need psychologists, psychiatrists, lawyers, and probation officers all sitting around, and police, sitting around the table, talking to each other. But we all have our own jargon. We have all our own languages. We have all our own niche and specialised ways of talking to each other. And sometimes we need to get a common, to speak at home I talk about simple, plain English. Don't make things complicated. We've got to make sure that everybody understands what we're saying in common terms. So multi-agency and multidisciplinary working is easy in principle, incredibly difficult to do properly and to do well. And I think it's somewhere that we need to do a huge amount of work to make it actually work better. And it's something we do most of the time because we're in the community and we're walking around. But again, you're coming back to the idea of it, of how we do it and what we do. And that's why I'm talking about the thing, is the whole idea of that data sharing. I've covered it. One of the things that's coming in this year, and I hope most people are aware of it already, is the GDPR, the data protection regulations that are coming in. And they are, there's a get out of jail card for criminal justice to allow a lot more discretion in what data is. But what it does do is it puts a challenge to us in how much data we retain on people and how we retain it and how we share it. And the reality of the matter is, certainly talking to colleagues both across Europe and everywhere, that there's a tendency at the moment to only retain data for the purpose for which you got it and then to get rid of it. Now, one of the classic things in criminal justice is that we keep everything and we were able to stitch things together. How we're going to be able to do that in a constructive, coherent way complying with the GDPR is a challenge, and certainly is one that I've been working with in Ireland to see how we can actually comply with the regulations, comply with the people's rights to get more knowledge about what we know about them. Because from a security point of view, it's important that not necessarily everybody knows what you know. So on one hand, I'm talking about information sharing. On the other hand, I'm talking about the limits to information sharing, and certainly the limits of the individual to what the state knows about them. Because it's important, again, that the data is protected. So I think I would ask you to think further as to how we can manage data protection, but how we can manage to use data and information constructively in engagement in criminal justice between everybody. And I keep coming back, cultural awareness and sensitivity is probably the most difficult thing, because it's how do you understand why people think? And again, it's somewhere I think the probation officers, that's their bread and butter, or should be their bread and butter, let's put it that way. They should be thinking about how do people think, why do people think, how do people act, and so on like that, on their behaviour. But how much do we understand of minorities in our jurisdiction? How much do we understand of how, for example, Roma, which is a common group appearing in courts, how much do people understand about why people work that way, why people live that way, and how people? Now, if you multiply that and you take that into other minorities, because we're a multicultural, multinational Europe at this stage, Ireland, which was traditionally a country where everybody emigrated from, we never had people coming into Ireland. It was everybody came for a holiday and went home again. And everybody in Irish knew where their grandfather and their great-grandfather was born. In the last 20 years, the population of Ireland has changed dramatically. And it's not just kind of immigrants or people, refugees. It's employment and it's young people and it's mobility because the world has changed. So at this stage now, 15% of our population were born outside Ireland. Now that's a change when I was going to school. It was a change when I was a probation officer in court first. It's a change in the last 20 years. So change is coming rapidly. And how do we understand how all these other people think in Ireland? And do they understand how we think? And do they understand our cultural norms? Do we understand their cultural norms? And I think the challenge to us now at the moment is, how do we understand and educate our staff about cultural sensitivity and cultural awareness? And how they can avoid being offensive? It's basic as that in their communications. So I think one of the areas that I would suggest that probation is wrestling with at the moment across Europe, but I think everyone else should be doing it as well, is how do we develop cultural intelligence, cultural awareness, and cultural sensitivity? Because if you want to work with people, you have to respect people. And to respect people, you have to understand where they're coming from. And sometimes you have to understand what their experience is. And again, if you're working with people that are called terrorists, you have to understand where they're thinking, why they're thinking, how they construct that thinking. So again, it's about what does probation, this is what for probation, these are the big issues and the big challenges, and I know we share them. And then the classic thing, and I mentioned at the beginning, the over-reliance on assessment. And when I started in probation in the 1970s, there were no risk assessments. It was your personal judgment. And as anybody would know, and the research tells us, it's about the most unreliable way of predicting reoffending and recidivism. And the whole idea of risk assessment instruments was to refine that and make it better. Now, it's refined it and made it better, but it hasn't made it perfect. And I think that's where we sometimes, and I often say to young probation officers, don't become hooked on the assessment instrument. It's an assist, it's a support, but it's not necessarily the whole answer. So we have to be able to keep a balance between the instruments. If it's no point going along to someone and saying, the score says you are. The score says you're in the risk area. But you may be the person who's the no risk, who's actually coming up in the high risk category. Because if you take a high risk category, a certain proportion of those people are never going to reoffend. If you take the low risk category, a certain proportion of them are going to reoffend. You just don't know who they are. And I think that's the question mark that hangs over risk assessment. It's work in development. I've been mentioning a book that's published just before Christmas by a forensic psychologist in the United Kingdom. His name is Robert Ford, and he talks about the title of the book is Bad Psychology. Now, he's not talking about the psychology itself being bad, but he's talking about how we use the psychology. We overinterpret it, we misuse it, we don't deliver the programs according to the way they're meant to be, because we get into bad habits. So I think it's very important to be aware of the fragility of psychology, the fragility of practice, because if you're doing the same job every day, you fall into habits. And when you fall into habits, you make mistakes. And we all do that. So you have to constantly be refreshing, constantly managing your discipline. But this is again about being coherent and relevant. So the messages I'm saying really are, what we're trying to do in probation are the same things that stretch across all of criminal justice. We have to be alert, and we have to be have realistic expectations. There is no magic bullet, there's no silver bullet, there's no magic wand, there's no cure as such. But there's best practice, and best practice requires an incredible amount of self-discipline, structure, and supervision among the practitioners, and also the readiness to change. Because what we're doing today as best practice, in 2 years' time, in 2 weeks' time, 2 months' time, will probably be superseded by better practice. And we have to be ready to change and move with that. So again, these are more the questions I'm highlighting are really the questions from what probation has learned from its practice and needs to be doing. I'm saying this is what we're trying to do in probation. It's what we're trying to move it along. The last one at the bottom is probably the one that causes most question marks and challenge. People talk about disengagement or de-radicalization. De-radicalization, using John Horgan's description, is talking about a process of attitudinal change where the cognitions supporting terrorism are addressed. Now that's a hell of a big challenge, because you're talking about changing people's complete mindset and how they're thinking. And I think, again, talking from the Irish experience and from some of the other jurisdictions' experience, disengagement is probably much more realistic as an objective, because what it aims to do is focus on the behavioural component of extremism. And it's looking at what people do. So effectively what disengagement is doing is you can think your radical thoughts, but as long as you don't act on your radical thoughts. You can think bad thoughts, but as long as you don't pick up a gun, as long as you don't help a terrorist, as long as you don't plant a bomb, that's okay by us. So it's the example of Northern Ireland. Again, I keep coming back to that. I don't think anybody who's been involved in the IRA campaigns or the loyalist campaigns who are not shooting people at the moment have changed their point of view. They still want to in the United Ireland, they still want to be part of the United Kingdom. But the important part is they're no longer killing people to make that point. And I think if you think of what the challenge of de-radicalization means, if it does, if we were trying to go that, we would have to try and change those people into different people. That's a hell of a challenge. It might be more practical and pragmatic to look at disengagement, at kind of basically working with them, working with the lower risk people to get them to step back from enabling terrorism. Because that's about having realistic ambitions and realistic goals. John Orla Lynch from University College Cork is the author of that, and that last quote there on disengagement. I brought along a couple of copies of her article, which I think we can have, but the links at the end, I'll give you references to where the articles are, primarily about that. And the other big thing that I think probation organisations are focusing on at the moment is capacity building. Building the skills and having staff, confidence among staff that they can do it. If you have a challenge and a problem, the best way to deal with it isn't necessarily to scare your own staff. It's about empowering them, it's about supporting them, it's about developing them, it's about investing in them. So you need to kind of upskill people, you need to educate people, rather than just telling people it's a really dangerous world out there. Of course it's a dangerous world out there. It's always been dangerous. It's just different dangers at different times. We have to be realistic in our expectations about what we can choose. We need to talk to each other. We need to create networks, not just among probation organisations, but across probation, police, courts, everybody, social workers. We need everybody talking to everybody else. And we need research and evaluation, and I'm sure if any look at my colleagues in the audience, the researchers, we do need to be constantly evaluating what we do. Does it work? And if it doesn't work, stop doing it. We have a very big habit of keep doing something because that's what we're doing, even if it doesn't work. So I think it's important to stop doing what doesn't work. We need to be constantly learning. We need to be constantly training and constantly new. We need better community. I've really laboured this point, multi-agency cooperation and understanding. We also need to talk to the media and explain what we're doing, because we tend, media likes to talk in headlines, and we are talking in complexity. We need to be able to communicate a complicated message in the best possible way in the media. That's going to be a way. And I'm going to highlight the cost effectiveness of community sanctions, because it costs a hell of a lot of money to keep people in prison. And if we can keep less people in prison and move them into the community, it will be more, it'll be more effective, and it'll also be a lot cheaper. So CEP, just a quick run through, because I'm running out of time, it's my problem of keeping going. CEP has specialised working groups on radicalisation. We had a meeting only last week in Brussels. We include radicalisation and violent extremism in all our conferences, because again, we have to. It's about this awareness and networking. And the summer school, and this is something that applies to everybody, next July there will be a summer school in Barcelona between the 3rd and 6th of July, organised by the Criminal Justice Platform, which comprises Europris for prison organisations, CEP for probation organisations, and the European Forum for Restorative Justice for restorative justice organisations, because I think something that's underestimated is the potential value of restorative justice in dealing with radicalisation. But again, I could be here all day. But I think that's something that would be very useful. Have a look at the CEP website, have a look at the programme, and have a chat with Joan Darnescu, who's here, who's one of the organisers of that, about that programme. And then go and visit the CEP website and look at some of the projects we're dealing with as well. So, end of, where are we at now? This is my conclusion, really. We can learn from each other, particularly from our experience, from our successes and our failures. We need to maintain an open, critical responsiveness to new ideas, and also to some old ones. Sometimes we have to go back to basics. We need to work more openly across disciplines, agencies and jurisdictions, with a respect for differences of the organisations and what each other brings to the table. And we need to continue to organise meetings like this to share and disseminate and to learn, and above all to listen. And I just want to give you one of my favourite quotes from a very optimistic and positive Irishman called Samuel Beckett, who people who know wrote Waiting for Godot. Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail again, fail better. Because I think we've got, the message is, we're never going to be perfect, but we've got to keep going better. So the key bit of that is, try again, fail better. And I would encourage everyone to take that with them. So these are the list of where some of the papers I've quoted there. I brought along a copy of Orla Lynch's paper, and I have some copies of Sigrid Reid's paper about assistance from the social identity perspective, and I think there's some key messages in there that we could transfer across boundaries. And thank you.